Hello there. Today's Tuesday, July 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump faces backlash over his comments in a news conference with Russia's leader.
I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all.
How the meeting with Putin impacts the Russian election meddling investigation. North Korea commits to returning remains of U.S. soldiers from the Korean War. And coffee growers are helping with conservation. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. lawmakers from both parties, political parties, reacted with shock and dismay Monday after President Donald Trump failed to support the U.S. intelligence community's conclusions about Russian meddling in the 2016 election during a news conference with President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki.
All I can do is ask the question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. President Putin, he just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded Russia interfered in the election, but Putin, in his remarks Monday, said the Russian state never interfered and doesn't plan to interfere in internal American electoral processes. Republican Senator Jeff Flake has been a longtime critic of Trump.
I mentioned myself that I thought it was shameful, and I never thought I'd see an American president throw the intelligence community under the bus like that and agree with a dictator, authoritarian like he did.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman was at the news conference in Helsinki and tells International Edition's Sarah Williams just what all occurred.
This was certainly a remarkable news conference. It'll probably end up being historical. Whether that will be something in the history books that will be good for the Trump presidency or not, it is way too early to tell because of the ongoing investigation being conducted by the special counsel. And that was referenced numerous times, including the issue of these 12 Russian intelligence officers that were indicted last week. And President Putin addressed that also, saying he would look into it, that they're alleged intelligence officers. And he invited special counsel Mueller to send his investigators to Russia. He said they can also make an official request for extradition. President Trump on the defensive on this issue, saying that he saw no reason to believe that Moscow had hacked into the election and helped him win, saying that the Russian president was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And in fact, on a number of issues, the president did note that he raised a number of matters, including Ukraine and Syria. But in all of these cases, he really did not offer a criticism of anything that Russia has been doing, and that is certain to be noted.
Trump spoke quite a bit about the election, and he kept repeating that he had won. He clearly had won. And he talked a lot about his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton's, talking again about her email servers. He kept talking about that.
Sure, very much an extension of what he's been saying for weeks, trying to put the focus on the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign and issues involving their computer servers. And really, this has been something that the president has done time and time again to change the narrative on this. But I think what is really notable is the fact that the president was essentially disagreeing with the conclusion of all of the major U.S. intelligence agencies and flying in the face of the indictments that the Russians were up to no good in the 2016 election. So I would think that Vladimir Putin has to be very pleased with the performance by Donald Trump here.
Putin was also asked by a reporter about whether the two leaders had talked about Russia's annexation of Crimea. The reporter also asked about any potential compromising information that the Russian government might have about Trump. And Putin responded to both of those.
Sure. I saw him cracking more than a little smile when that question was raised. And Putin did go into a bit of a humorous vein in his response on that, saying that he was an intelligence officer, and he does know how dossiers can be made up. He said, as far as, you know, anything involving the president being compromised or his campaign being involved in collusion with the Russians, quote, the final say is for the courts to deliver. But specifically concerning this dossier and the most salacious material involving a trip by Donald Trump when he was a businessman, President Putin basically said that Trump was not under surveillance when he visited Russia, that there was no reason to surveil, and wouldn't really think that they would be spying on every single American businessman who comes to Russia, and that was utter nonsense to imagine. Although he didn't turn to President Trump and saying, you know, we don't have any such dirt on you. But the president himself, President Trump, responded saying he believes that if there was any truth to that, that such information would have come out a long time ago. So a very fascinating and newsworthy encounter between these two presidents standing at the podiums discussing this issue, which has been consuming American politics now for many, many months.
Yeah, the two leaders indicated they want to meet more often or more regularly.
Yes, I think that was something that President Putin emphasized a number of times during this news conference here, and that he is looking for better cooperation. There is that issue of the sanctions that the United States has on Russia. And while that wasn't addressed at the news conference, Putin said that it's clear that business people in both the United States and Russia want better economic cooperation. And he's proposing a dialogue involving all people from all different types of professions from the United States and Russia to get together. And Putin also emphasized cooperation in counterterrorism and cybersecurity. So I think we can definitely say from the position, as Donald Trump put it, where he had characterized until today the relations between Moscow and Washington being at their worst state ever, he said that that changed as of 4 hours ago.
All right. Well, Democratic leaders are calling on Republicans to take a strong stance against the president's position on Russia. And the meeting between the two leaders follows Friday's indictments of 12 Russian military intelligence officers alleged to have hacked into Democratic Party and campaign accounts. Trump has never condemned Russia over the meddling in the 2016 election, despite the findings of all top U.S. intelligence agencies. And the Kremlin has insisted it didn't meddle in the U.S. election. Joining us for further analysis, former Central Intelligence Agency officer Jack Rice. Jack, what is your reaction to the news conference, given all of this?
I have never seen anything like it. For President Trump to actually side with the Russians, blame the Americans, deny all of the intelligence that was presented, and then turn around and say, we're sorry, is like a domestic abuse victim apologizing to their attacker. That's what we saw in this particular case. I've never seen anything like it. I am dumbfounded.
What struck you the most, or was it just the entirety of it?
What struck me the most was his willingness to defer to Vladimir Putin. He has a role as the quote-unquote leader of the free world. His job is not just to stand up for general principles that the United States believes in, but also for American intelligence, American defense, American business. All of those things are relatively important. But at the same time, what you don't do is you don't defer to the Russians and simply say, oh, well, if you say it, then it must be true, because everybody else was lined up together and collectively said the answer is something fundamentally different. His obligation is to stand up for the United States and for American interests. What he did was just the opposite of that.
Both of them were asked about the Mueller investigation into Russia's meddling into the 2016 campaign. And one of the reporters actually asked President Putin if he wanted Trump to win and if he asked his administration to actually help with that. And he said, yes, I did. I did want him to win. So that sort of contradicts a lot of what the president has certainly said, that Putin supposedly wanted Hillary Clinton to win.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, in the end, what Vladimir Putin wanted, what his desire was, I don't think was particularly shocking. We know that the relationship that he had with Hillary Clinton was not a very good one. We know that Hillary Clinton was very clear and incredibly strong when it came to the issue of the Russian invasion of Crimea. So we know about that. So that doesn't shock me whatsoever. But what I do think is shocking, really, is what the Russians actually did purposely to tried to manipulate the election process and the election cycle, and how President Trump has somehow continued to try to deny that that is the case, and more importantly, undercut the U.S. intelligence community while he's doing it. So I imagine being an intelligence officer trying to recruit assets around the world right now. And those assets are looking at what an American president is doing, siding with the Russians themselves, denying the accuracy of the American, and frankly, the competency of American intelligence. It's going to make things so much harder, and frankly, so much more dangerous for the United States to operate on the world stage. This is coming with a cost, and the cost is American credibility, American stability, American power on a worldwide stage. And the problem is, at this point, I can't see anything the United States is actually getting out of it. If he was doing this for some particular purpose because he thought, we're going to get some incredible thing, what thing are we getting? We're not getting anything, and it's costing us, and it's costing us big.
So why do you think that this is happening? Why do you think President Trump is so reluctant to ever criticize President Putin, is so quick to criticize U.S. allies like Germany and Britain, and yet continue to give a pass to Russia? Is there more to this, and is that something that involves possibly the Mueller investigation?
You know, there's the part of me that wants to say, you know, is he dirty? Is he dirty because of the Russia? Or is he just incompetent? It runs sort of the gambit. There's the one side where I can say, well, I could see if you were dirty, you would behave like this. On the other hand, if you were just simply incompetent, I guess I could see how you would behave like this as well. But the one thing that I have seen that is consistent about this president is he seems to like dictators. He likes people who have the power to force everybody around them to bow down. And if I'm looking for consistency, the consistency seems to be that he supports that ilk. But anybody who isn't of that ilk, he sees differently. There's an old adage that the kiss up, kick down sort of approach to the world. The problem is it seems that he sees the totalitarian dictator as those with whom he should be kissing up, and anybody who is not that, those he should be kicking down.
That's former CIA officer, currently a criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice. Well, the meeting with Russia's president comes on the heels of Trump's attendance at the NATO summit in Brussels and a visit to the UK. Joining us now from London is reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, before we get to the UK visit, have you had any reaction there in London or England in general about the news conference between Trump and Putin?
Of course, the contents of this press conference have been all over the headlines. Obviously, the newspapers had already been put to bed by the time this news came out, but everyone's obviously been updating websites, quoting John Brennan as saying, you know, this was treasonous. That word treasonous is being used heavily in all of the news coverage. And I think, of course, this morning across all of the news programs, that's all we're going to hear about. But remember, we also have our own drama here with Brexit. A lot of hard lines are being drawn on both sides. So while this is going to get serious play, we can't forget that there's another domestic story that is seen as sort of equally as important.
Right, of course. And President Trump also had somewhat of a tumultuous 24 hours or less on British soil.
He did. In less than 24 hours here, he managed to insult the Prime Minister and the Mayor of London, and he also managed to meddle in domestic affairs as well as foreign policy. So quite a storm he stirred up. It started with a sensational interview that Trump did with British tabloid newspaper The Sun, proclaiming that former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who had literally just resigned his post over the Brexit agreement, Trump essentially proclaimed that Boris Johnson would make a great prime minister, essentially subtly suggesting that there should be an election called and that Johnson would make a better prime minister than Theresa May. Now, as you can imagine, this is totally inappropriate for any foreign leader to make these kind of comments in any foreign country. Even during an election, you would not hear any foreign leader expressing these kind of comments favoring one side or even one person over another. So he basically insulted his host before they had even met up. He also spoke of the fact that he had given Theresa May advice about Brexit that she didn't take, and how he thought that was a huge mistake on her part. We later learned from Theresa May herself that that advice from Trump was the suggestion to sue the European Union. So you can imagine you know, the UK is not nearly as litigious a society as the US, so I'm sure this garnered more than a few chuckles, just the notion that the UK or that Theresa May herself would be able to sue the EU. It was quite laughable. But it was interesting to see how Theresa May reacted to this chaotic storm that Trump brought with him. She really handled it with her usual sense of calm. I imagine she was trying to bring some grace and dignity to the situation. Unfortunately, many Brits saw it as the opposite. Many Brits criticized her, believing that her inactions, her unwillingness to confront Trump and even cancel their planned meeting and the big ceremonial dinner that was planned at Blenheim Palace, that her refusal to do any of this was seen as submissive and pandering. And then, of course, there were the cringeworthy pictures, not just once, but twice, of Trump holding May's hand while they walked to the press conference and then to dinner that evening. And Theresa May, you know, brushed it off and just said, look, he seems to reach for my hand or my arm anytime we're going down a slope or stairs. You know, there's nothing more to this. But nonetheless, Trump haters were outraged. But whatever her critics say, May really didn't have very much choice in how to handle this. Diplomacy was really her only option. Remember, the U.S. and the U.K. are practically the two closest allies in the world. So diplomacy and brushing it off was the only option here. And even more pragmatically, the U.K. is desperately hoping to secure a big trade deal with the U.S. when it exits the EU. So Theresa May treated this visit as what it was, which was all business. And I think she was quite right not to get flustered by any of this.
Well, she certainly seemed to do a good job of that. There was another little incident that sort of made a lot of headlines, and that was, of course, when President Trump met with the Queen and seemed to walk in front of her.
Well, yeah, I think there were more than a few awkward moments during this incredibly fleeting visit. And yes, that was awkward, and it was another cringeworthy moment. I think the bottom line is that President Trump is someone who does not take direction, does not necessarily take guidance or heed advice, will not be told what to do, even if that relates to the simplest of protocol with someone that he admires as much as the Queen. He simply will not be told what to do. So I'm quite certain he would have been advised to allow her to go first, if for no other reason than she's his elder and she's a woman, but Trump will do what Trump will do. And he is highly unpredictable. And I think, you know, we saw evidence of that in his appearance with the Queen.
All right. London-based reporter Amy Gutman, thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. judge has temporarily halted the deportations of recently reunited immigrant families. The U.S. and NATO-led coalition officials refute report of direct U.S. talks with the Taliban. Lava crashes through the roof of a Hawaii tour boat, injuring 23 people. And the female-run Syrian TV is seeking to empower women. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. After a diplomatic snub, North Korea is making firm commitments to help the U.S. restart the search for its fallen Korean War soldiers. Reuters' Joel Labby reports.
After standing up the U.S. last week, North Korea has come back to the diplomatic table. The two sides met over the weekend with a follow-up on Monday on an agreement reached at President Donald Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un, bringing home the remains of soldiers who perished in the Korean War. More than 7,000 personnel remain unaccounted for. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a Sunday statement that talks ended in firm commitments to restart searches across one-time battlefields. Pompeo has said the talks came out of his visit to Pyongyang earlier this month when he highlighted the issue as a key point of progress for both sides. At the time, though, the North accused his delegation of making gangster-like demands over denuclearization. At the Singapore summit, Kim Jong-un made a broad commitment to work towards dismantling his nuclear program with few details as to how. Things may now be moving forward, though. Pompeo said after his most recent visit, he's made progress on a timeline for disposing of Pyongyang's nuclear weapons. As for the fallen troops, the regime has said it's holding the remains of some 200 soldiers. But a U.S. military official told Reuters last month it's unclear what North Korea may hand over. South Korean media say American forces have moved around 100 wooden coffins to the demilitarized zone that separates the Koreas in anticipation of a diplomatic breakthrough.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24-7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. 2017 was the worst or second worst year on record for the loss of tropical forest cover, according to a report from Global Forest Watch. And while many countries have pledged to restore forest land, doing so while providing an income for people who live there is a challenge. But as VOA's Steve Barragona tells us, coffee may help.
Mozambique has lost two-fifths of its forest since 1970 to slash-and-burn farming, illegal logging, and civil war. These coffee trees are part of a plan to bring a bit of forest back. Coffee farmer Rondino Faduco works at Gorongosa National Park.
We are cultivating coffee and native plants to restore the forest.
The coffee plants thrive in the shade of the native trees. Together, they capture rainfall that feeds the rivers that supply people and wildlife downstream. The water supply has suffered from the loss of forest, says Quentin Harhoff, head of the Gorongosa Coffee Project.
And the more we plant in here, the more we stop erosion, the more we become make this place like a sponge, and we restore the hydrology of this mountain.
Simply returning trees to the hillsides would do the job, but it would do nothing for the people who live here. Amelia Nasir processes the coffee the farmers grow.
We are using coffee in the restoration project because it's impossible for us in Mozambique. Restoration one area took the people out for that area, doesn't give nothing.
Coffee, on the other hand, is providing farmers with more income than they made from traditional farming, Harhoff says.
This is the only way we can get them to believe in it, is by actually seeing what can be done on a very small area of land. The significance of this is that you cut down slash and burn, because one family can live on 1 hectare and make much more revenue than the traditional system of slash and burn.
Revenue and restoration, Harhoff says shade-grown coffee can help the people and the environment of Mozambique. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Well, Ethiopia has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, where 1 in 27 women die during childbirth. To address that problem, maternity waiting homes have opened up in parts of Ethiopia to encourage more women who live in remote areas to deliver at a health facility where they can receive the services and newborn care they need. VOA's Julie Tabot has more.
Mezgebe Waini is recovering at a maternity waiting home in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. The 19-year-old recently lost her baby after a prolonged labor and had to undergo surgery. She's here because it's close to her home and makes it easier for skilled health workers to monitor her progress.
I would have lost my life if I attempted to deliver at home and if I didn't receive the necessary treatment and care at the hospital. My house is about an hour drive from here by car.
To help improve maternal and childcare health in remote areas, Ethiopia's government and the international development charity Voluntary Service Overseas set up about 20 maternity waiting homes around the country, where pregnant women, especially those at high risk, can have access to proper health care. This is the Mulu Asefa Hospital.
Hey, maternity room, waiting area, mnilo.
This maternity waiting home is essential for this area because we have people living in very remote areas who could be in labor outside the mobile telephone network coverage or difficult to reach by ambulance. So we thought it would be safer for them to stay here up to a week before their anticipated day of delivery.
A decade ago, the Ethiopian government hired 30,000 basic health workers to provide preventive and curative health care services across the country. But for the more than 85% of Ethiopians who live in rural areas, the nearest health clinic can be hundreds of kilometers away. Most Ethiopian women still deliver at home, with 57% helped by a relative, and 28% by a traditional birth attendant. But more women are learning about the risks associated with childbirth. Although pregnancy-related deaths have fallen in recent years, the country still has some of the highest maternal and neonatal death rates in the world. 30% of deaths among women aged 15 to 49 are due to pregnancy and childbirth.
We focused in this area because it's located in the border of Afar. So these people are nomads. They are walking around. They are not settled in one place. And this hospital is serving 1 million population. So if we set a maternity waiting home here, it serves not only the population in the Aspi area, it also serves in the community coming from the other regions like Afar.
There are plans to expand the maternity waiting homes program in the near future to accommodate more pregnant women and to bring skilled prenatal and postnatal care in remote regions. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 9th, Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed determined to resolve the differences between their countries by signing a peace accord that will end two decades of hostilities. For 5 years after Eritrea achieved its independence from Ethiopia by referendum in 1993, the two countries enjoyed cordial relations. But a 1998 dispute over border issues escalated into a vicious war that cost over 80,000 lives. The hostilities ceased in 2000, but the two countries maintained a military stalemate over the disputed territory. Aside from an end to the long-running hostilities, a peace agreement would result in significant benefits for both countries. Ethiopia is a landlocked country, but good relations with Eritrea would afford it access to Assab and Massawa, ports on the Red Sea, one of the world's busiest shipping routes from Asia to Europe via the Suez Canal. Eritrea, on the other hand, would have the opportunity to improve its economy, which had been severely damaged by the war with Ethiopia and hamstrung by the subsequent stalemate. The country is isolated, and many Eritreans have emigrated. The United States welcomes the July 9th commitment to peace and security between the State of Eritrea and the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, effectively ending 20 years of conflict, said U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a written statement. We commend Prime Minister Abiy of Ethiopia and President Isaias of Eritrea for courageously leading their citizens toward peace, prosperity, and political reform. The normalization of relations and the adoption of the Joint Declaration of Peace and Friendship between Eritrea and Ethiopia will provide their peoples with the opportunity to focus on shared aspirations for closer political, economic, and social ties, said Secretary Pompeo. The United States stands ready to support this process and encourages all parties to continue working with transparency and confidence in the coming days. Peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea will further the cause of stability, security, and development in the Horn of Africa and Red Sea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.